So it's a genuine pleasure to be here. So I've had a chance to connect with some of you. Some of you know, I got my PhD here in Croydon in 1990. And Hartle was my advisor, and I can't recommend it's a better advisor. And that leads into my title, which is Why Would a Theoretical Physicist Study the Optical Domain? I'm here not to represent the entire physics of hearing program, although I am representative of it. There's no way that I could talk about everything that's going on, especially so I'm just going to give what I think is a flavor of what's going on, and especially the things that I think this audience will be interested in. Please interrupt me at any time. I'm going to keep everything inside an hour, which means I'm going to skip lots of things. But if I skip anything critical, then I'd rather go back and not get to the end, but be understandable the whole time. And just so, because I prepared too many things, and I want to acknowledge that, I have a bunch of topics that I'm not going to cover, but maybe there'll be time for one at the end if there's general consensus I should. One of them is what happens to the auditory brain as you get older, which would be subtitled Why Everyone Starts Mumbling. I have a case study, just a nice simple example of differential geometry that I was lucky enough to be able to use in optical neuroscience. A simple kids example of how just a very simple physics and math can tell you something about the auditory system. And what if I could change fields from theoretical physics to experimental neuroscience? That's usually what I talk about if I give a talk to most of grad students. All right, so why would one change fields from auditory neuroscience from theoretical physics? I mean, basically, it's because the brain is really cool. If you have a choice of what to study in many, many interests, the brain is really, was for me, way, way up there. It does a lot of cool things. Culturally, societally, we think of the brain as the place that holds our conscious thoughts, our doubts, our memories, our dreams. From the biological point of view, it does do all of those things, but most brains may or may not do all those things, and there's lots of things. The brain is a general purpose tool that's been evolved evolutionarily throughout the animal kingdom. It's the basis of our interface to the world. And interface to the world in two different parts. One is how the things out there affect us, so that's the sensory input. And then that goes into what most animals have, which I'll just call the middle part of the brain. And then the other really critical part is the motor output. So the most simple part, the most simple brains really only need to have input to output. There's something going on out here, how does that change what I do? But very quickly, brains evolve to do much more than that. To be able to store or do lots of processing in the middle, so that it's not as simple as everything going on around you, because everything going on around you is really complicated. There's too much stuff going on around you. It turns out that active filtering, modeling of what's going on around you makes you a much better animal, makes you a much better mover, makes you a much better reproducer. So I did make this switch, that's the basic interest. The basic reason why one would study the brain is because it is really cool. I'm skipping a lot here, and that's probably a good thing. One other thing that helped is that there's a history or sociology in neuroscience that physicists have come in the past and done more good than harm. It's not universally true. There's some really wonderful examples. Volta is well known for discovering that you can transduce electrical signals into motor movements in a frog, dead frog leg. One of my favorite examples is Ernst Mach. Mach is most well known in popular culture for speed of going faster than the speed of sound, the speed of sound work. He's very well known in relativity for his ideas of inertia and especially inertia in rotating systems. What does inertia really mean from a cosmological gravity point of view? What's less well known about him in physics is that he discovered an entirely new sense, and it's really related to this sense of rotational inertia. He discovered the vestibular sense. It's not one of the classical five senses. It's the sense that we have when we're rotating, that we are rotating. And he was, as well as being a theorist, he was an experimentalist, and he built this chair, which on his giant arm could swim people around in circles. And he put blindfolds on subjects and asked them when they were rotating and when they weren't, even though they couldn't see that they were rotating, and was able to prove that rotation, the sense of rotation, is intrinsic to our nervous system and our brain, and is not just deduced based on other cues. In the auditory system, Helmholtz is well known for his contributions to the theories of the auditory system. So we think of this middle part as being what's really going on with the brain. I'm going to be talking about this combination of the input and the middle. Unless you're a neuroscientist, you suffer a lot of delusions about the world. One of the delusions that we suffer from is that the world is an orderly place, and the signals we get, for instance, the visual cues, light coming at things, are all orderly. We all suffer from the delusion that every one of these chairs in this room has the same color. If you know anything about basic physics, though, the light coming into our eyes from these chairs depends a little bit on what we call the color of the chair, but mostly it depends on light reflecting off from sources off the chair. If you look at the spectrum of the light coming from any of these chairs, the spectra are all completely different. There's no way that you could easily tell a computer program to say, look at all of these spectra coming from all these different chairs and tell me what color the chair is. The chair doesn't have a color. The chair has these properties. But our brain decides, through evolution it decides, that it's better to come up with some commonality, that there is this property to how light reflects. In some animals, it can even be what the polarization of the light is. That gives a certain intrinsic quality, and we call that a color. And we perceive that as a color, but that's our brain, not our eyes. Our eyes just get the spectrum, and the spectrum is a mess. That concept is called color constancy. Similarly with the auditory system. Hopefully, most of you are hearing my voice as the sound going on in this room. There's lots of other sounds. It's really okay to be eating something and chewing and crinkling paper during the Blackboard talk. But one of the reasons that Blackboard lunchtime talks work is because we don't hear them. You can hear them, you can choose to focus on them, and if they're right next to you, maybe you can turn it off. But for the most part, all of these other sounds are going on all the time, and if you looked at them on an oscilloscope, they would be pretty loud. And maybe in this room, because of the way it's designed, they wouldn't be as loud as me. But if we were outside and I was talking and you could easily hear me over all the other sounds, those other sounds could easily be as loud or louder than me. So the brain is doing this, and that's in fact the part of the auditory brain that I study, is how does the brain make sense of the world? How does the brain know to take all of the sounds that go into our ears, because our ears just take in everything. They don't care what's important. And then turn it into the thing that we call hearing, which in very simple cases may be the same as the sounds going into your ear. But in most natural, ordinary situations, the two are very different. I do want to talk about other things going on in the workshop. This is a good time. There's a large contingency in the physics of hearing workshop that really does much more physics. They're studying how squishy, wet cells that have terrible properties in terms of reliability can actually turn acoustic vibrations from a few hertz to up to 100 kilohertz into neural signals, into representations that can be transmitted neurally, not only transmitted, but can be used for computation inside the brain neurons. So that's a great area here. We heard actually a really good talk on insect hearing. I don't know if Danielle is here. On how a specific kind of fly, Ormia, can localize sounds, even though the wavelength of those sounds are much, much greater than the distance between the ears. So that's sort of impossible. Unless there's some extra structure going on. That doesn't even mention that these flies can also fly around like jet pilots despite having a brain that's smaller than a breadcrumb. There's also people talking here about how humans in particular are particularly good at creating sounds with our mouths, with our vocal cords, and receiving those sounds. And we're so good at making and receiving these sounds, we use it for something that has nothing to do with sounds, which is language or abstract ideas. You talk about mathematics. These things are completely dissociated by any way that anyone would design the world, taking acoustic vibrations and using them to communicate something like language. But we do it. Speech is not necessary for language at all. Anyone who knows American Sign Language or any other sign language knows that you don't need sounds for language. But evolutionarily, that's how we first developed it. And that's because we're really good at these speech-like sounds, both creating and receiving them. And there's a large group of people here also studying that. Questions so far? All right. Can't interrupt me. So I study what's called the cocktail party problem. The cocktail party problem is when you're at a cocktail party or a bar or at a restaurant, and everyone's talking at the same time, then a young, healthy brain has no trouble picking out one source of speech and listening to that and understand everything they're saying. This is a really difficult problem to solve, especially from the mathematical point of view. From the mathematical point of view, all of the sounds going into our ears mix linearly in the air. And so if there are, let's say, 5 sound sources coming at you, and the particular pressure at your ear right now is 7 in some units, and you're asked to say, of that 7, which parts came from which of those sources, you can't do it. Even if it's 2. 7 could be 3 plus 4, but it could be 5 plus negative 2. It's intrinsically an unsolvable problem mathematically. The way we can solve it, because we really do solve it, is we make certain assumptions. We make assumptions that the sounds coming into our ears can be separated. That's a big assumption right there. We make assumptions that if there are 2 distinct pitches, that maybe those are from 2 different sources. We can do some sound localization if they're coming from 2 different places. That's definitely helpful. But from an algorithmic point of view, they're still mixing before they come into the ears. And so you can't say we're just separating based on where they are, because we haven't figured out algorithmically how to separate them into 2 different sources coming from different places yet. So there's lots of chicken and egg problems there. So one of the optional topics I can do at the end is I've also been investigating, even though we can do this really well, why it becomes harder as we get older. That just happens naturally. And I don't have any advice. I have little bits of advice, but not really, really helpful advice. All right, so let me talk about sound. sound is it's useful evolutionarily because like light, because it comes in waves, it can propagate information from distant places to you. Other senses can do that. So vision is one. Olfaction, sense of smell, odors can come in from distance. We've basically evolved for our external senses the ability to be able to process physical information, which can convey helpful information. From the point of view of a signal, a sound is really a pressure wave. That's not really how we perceive it. We really perceive sounds as by their frequency content. For the most part, we perceive sounds much more like a version which musical notation is an abstraction. We perceive that there are sounds that turn on and off, whereas it's really hard to see that from this point of view. And those sounds typically have different frequency content, and perhaps they even have different pitch content. So to be more useful as a representation, we very often use time frequency representations. So something where we can have frequency time. Now, we can't do that just by taking the Fourier transform. The Fourier transform removes time entirely. There are ways around this. One of the ones that's most interesting from a physics point of view is the Fourier distribution. So that's a function of time and frequency, like we want here. And it's given by 1 over 2 pi, the integral from minus infinity to infinity. This is for a signal s of t, s star of t minus 1 half tau times s of t plus 1 half tau e to the minus I, change my j's to i's, tau omega d tau. Most sounds that we hear aren't complex, but very common we'll use and we call the analytic version of sound. It's the sound plus I times its Hilbert transform. So what this does is it says we can use our signal s of t, and we can look at it at a particular time, but we can look at it also away from that time. And if we Fourier transform in that dimension, in that cross-time dimension, then we get a time frequency representation. This is related, not too surprisingly, to the quantum mechanics version of this that Wigner also created, which is 1 over pi h bar, integral from minus infinity to infinity, psi star of q plus y, psi of q minus y, e to the 2i p y over h bar dy. So this is a way of taking a quantum mechanical wave function psi and talking about it in terms of both its frequency content and its time content at the same time. And if you do the variable substitution, y goes to minus q prime over 2, set h bar equal to 1, you'll see that they're actually the same. The Wigner distribution for sounds turns out to be interesting from a theoretical point of view. It's not so interesting from a practical point of view. It has some features that are that take away from intuition of how to use it. For instance, one of the features that it suffers from is that it's difficult to make it positive definite. It almost always has some negative component to it. And for when we're processing sounds from a more perceptual point of view, we don't have the idea of a negative sound, a lack of sound. We have a view of positive sounds. Another problem with it from an experimental point of view is that if you have the Wigner distribution of a bunch of sounds and you take the average, which is something we often need to do in experimental neuroscience, then that thing that you get is not the Wigner distribution of a signal. So it's not invertible. We use other distributions that are related. I'm going to skip a little bit. I want to talk about another use in physics that I saw recently of this time-frequency distribution. Which this was, let's see, this was about 30 hertz. This was about 300 hertz. This was about 100 milliseconds. And this was in the news last week.
Yeah? Good question. You refer to both of these distributions, but they're a very different kind, right? The one in quantum mechanics is some approximation to like phase space distribution of a particle, where it's like probabilistic, whereas the one in that you're using in auditory is not a probabilistic distribution.
Well, so I would take issue with psi being probabilistic. It is the wave function. It can be used to calculate probabilities. But until one decides to do that, it is just the thing of quantum mechanics, and it evolves linearly with time.
Well, would you consider W of QP to be... Isn't W of QP some approximation to the phase-space distribution?
W of QP is exact. It can be used as a generating function for all kinds of quantum properties.
But it's not a distribution itself.
It's basic. If you don't take the Fourier transform, it's an autocorrelation. But it contains all of the information in the signal. In the original waveform, it's just a way that's more useful if you want to be able to go back and forth between position and frequency. So this I just saw in the news last week. This is what the chirp that Echo got detected for its third black hole merger looks like, or in fact sounds like, for the auditory neuroscientists. This is a beautiful example of a frequency modulated sweep, or a chirp. Over the course of a tenth of a second, you go up a factor of 10 in frequency. And you can write it this way. It looks small and slow, and then it gets bigger and faster. But if you listen to it, you don't hear this. You hear this. And it just so happens that these LIGO signals, for no good reason, are in auditory or acoustic ranges for us. What we typically do, for no good reason, except maybe historical, is we use a spectrogram representation. For a spectrogram representation, you take your signal and you break it up into intervals. And each one of these you Fourier transform. And then for convenience, we'll turn that sideways. And so you'll get this Fourier transform. And then you'll get the changed Fourier transform. I'm just giving amplitudes here. I'm not giving phase here. And then you have a representation where each one of these has a time data. And you'll have frequency as a function of time. And tracer. With a little smoothing, you can get things like where you can have frequency content changing as a function of time. So this is an abstraction of that this might be some of the phonemes in the word. It will be nicely harmonically stacked. Those will be vowels that have a nice pitch. There might be some places where you have a shh, where there's no frequency content, there's no harmonic content at all, there's no pitch, it's just broadband noise. And you might have sweeps like oo or ee. Those are exaggerated, but they're pretty common also. All right.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Can you get any useful information by, say, assuming the power is constant, so of your signal, so the sum of the squares of the amplitudes are constant, and you have a bunch of signals?
Almost never. So the kinds of signals we care about have a very large dynamic range, and over time, sounds can get very loud and very soft. So, in general, no.
Another question. Yeah. Is there evidence that the brain effectively uses any particular mathematical transformation along these lines or something else?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one that's typically used. There are ones that are much more biologically motivated, because the way our inner ear actually works is that the acoustic signal can get processed in parallel by many different neurons, hair cells they're called. They're not actually hairs, but and each one of them is tuned by how it's made, but also especially by where it is, to different frequencies. And so then one can look at how each of these neural transducers works, and then make models of that. So typically, it's an array of bandpass filters. Each filter is tuned to a specific frequency. It has some width. They're typically also non-linear, but we may, for our purposes, assume linearity until we don't have to. So those representations are really much more useful in terms of what the brain does, and so they're also much more useful in terms of our perception. They have the disadvantage that the more detailed they are, then the less benefit we get at an event like this. There was one other thing I wanted to say about that. Oh, yeah, so just also going back to quantum mechanics. So one of the nice things about these models, or spectrographic representations, is that they show what's reflected on the auditory nerve, on the nerve that conveys this information from the ear to the brain. The spectrogram has a more convenient representation in terms of what we perceive at a more gross level, in the sense that we can think of things that frequency can be a function of time, that the frequency content is this function of time. And so they're separable in that sense. For a bigger distribution, that is nonsense. Time is frequency, frequency is time, they're all completely interrelated. But there is, in quantum mechanics, the classical limit of a bigger distribution, which is when you integrate over enough degrees of freedom that you can say, I'm only going to look at these slower time scales and these higher frequencies. And if you do that, then things can separate out. You have to lose information. A spectrogram does that nicely, depending on what parameters you use, I mean, what width of time you use to do this. But if you have time here that's, say, on the order of a hertz, so going up to, say, 50 hertz, so things are allowed to change in time, a few hertz or a few tens of hertz, and the only frequencies you consider are 50 hertz up to, say, 20 kilohertz, then that's, in some sense, from the quantum mechanical point of view, the classical limit where you can separate the two. So that would be the classical optical limit. There's no photons anymore. There's just light. That happens in the cortex. That's the part of the brain that I study most. But that's not possible in the more fundamental representations where it's truly mixed up. I don't want to give the impression there's anything quantum mechanical going on here. This is only quantum versus classical in the sense of a Heisenberg uncertainty principle doesn't have to have an H-bar in it. you can talk about it just from the Fourier point of view. So it's much more of a Fourier limit than the Heisenberg limit, but Fourier limit's not used so widely.
Is what you're saying equivalent to understanding how fast these transducers for a given frequency can change time?
Yes, so it is related to that. So in this, in the limit where, in the before this limit is reached, where there's still lots more information, then yes, these transducers can match the oscillations of the sound up to a kilohertz or a few kilohertz, and the dynamics of that can change over many milliseconds. So that's a place where you've got things oscillating at kilohertz and changing in milliseconds, and so it's intrinsically messed up. Mixed up, I shouldn't say messed up. By the time we get to our more coarser perceptions, and where the cortex has received all this information in a much more distributed representation, then we can talk about something that's happening at a kilohertz is not represented as something oscillating at a kilohertz. It's these are kilohertz neurons that they are active. And those kilohertz neurons can then turn on and off at a few hertz. I think I'll skip auditory objects. And I'm going to talk about the way that I measure what's going on in people's brains. So there's lots of different ways to go inside a brain and see what's going on. One level, the best way is to take a sharp electrode and stick it inside a neuron that is processing sound in either part of the brain or possibly even in that part of the brain in the entire animal. So that's a way of getting very, very detailed information about what that neuron does in terms of processing sounds. That's hard. People definitely do it. People that are very skilled to do this. A little bit easier is to put an electrode near some neurons in the brain. Then we don't know what's going on inside any neuron, but you can see the activity going on in the neighborhood. Those are not done typically in people. We typically do not stick electrodes into people, but we do stick them into animals. A counterexample to that is that there are some people with severe epilepsy, and these epilepsy patients for whom medication is not working are candidates for surgery, and these surgical candidates are already having electrodes stuck into the brain to figure out which parts of the brain need to be removed and which parts of the brain can be saved. And sometimes it really matters. You don't want to take away the speech and language area. Because the quality of life would be so terrible. So among these patients, one can ask, while you're in the hospital, a candidate for surgery, and all these electrodes are measuring your activity in case you have a seizure, sort of hoping that you have a seizure from that point of view, do you want to take part in molecule experiments? And a bunch of people say yes. So we can do some invasive recording in people, but it's very limited. One has to be really, really careful about how one asks. And this is diseased tissue also. So far, we have no reason to believe that what we're seeing in this tissue is not indicative of healthy tissue, but one always has to be concerned. And certainly people who have a lifetime of severe epilepsy have cognitive issues. There's some neurological tolls that have taken place. So what I do is I look at what's going on inside people's brains without going inside them. I look at what's going on outside and infer what's going on inside. I use a technique called magnetoencephalography, MEG for short. It's related to electroencephalography called EEG, much more common. Magnetoencephalography uses superconducting quantum interference devices. So there's these little loops of superconducting metal coils that are, when they're supercooled, there are very, very sensitive measures of magnetic fields. For the sizes we're using, they can go down to easily a few femtotesla. And the signals that we're measuring from the brain are a few hundred femtotesla. So that's great. It's a great match for us. Why is there magnetism in the brain? Well, for Maxwell's equations, in in general, but in particular, Oersted's law, which I had to look up because I'd forgotten that one. If you have a current going through a wire, it generates a magnetic field, and neurons carry electrical current through their dendrites. They act a lot like wires. You might suspect that the magnetic field generated by one of these neural currents is very small. It really is. But if you've got 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th, maybe even 10 to the 6th neurons processing the same sound at the same time, and in cortex, they are all carrying currents in the same direction, those magnetic fields can really add up to a few hundred femtotesla, which is not really big either, but that's all we need because we have access to a few femtotesla. So my typical experiments, I have people go in because the EEG is much softer. You can just put it on people's heads. Because these sensors have to be cooled with liquid helium, then they're over here in a Dewar, and the Dewar is shaped such that it's in the shape of like an old-fashioned hairdryer. And you stick your head in, and it picks up magnetic fields. We've got about 200 sensors, so we've got the magnetic fields all around your head. And then I have my subjects listen to sounds. They're typically undergrads, with any students, one has to make sure that whatever they're listening to is interesting and they don't fall asleep. If it's a sleep study, that's someone else's. And the sounds they listen to are the ones that, because I study the cocktail party, are typically people talking, usually several people talking at the same time over each other. And so I look at what the neural signals are that are coming from different parts of their brain, different parts of auditory cortex, as these sounds are processed. So for instance, the sounds going into the auditory nerve create neural responses there, which I can't see with MEG because the currents there are too small. But those reflect entirely the sound scene, the sound that's going on. So they'll reflect everything going on there, including all the crumpling bags and chewing. But when you get to enough parts of the higher up in the brain where some of this processing has taken place, then enough modeling has been done, enough feedback has been applied to what the sounds most likely are, that the sound of interest, the sound component of interest, can be segregated out. And the way I design my experiments, those sounds usually can be segregated out. And then those parts of the brain are responding only to the sound that we perceptually perceive. They respond to what we hear as opposed to the sound going into our ears.
So what is the spatial resolution you get in the brain?
So this spatial resolution, that's an excellent point. So it's in practice, it's a centimeter or a few centimeters. So for anyone who sticks an electrode inside the brain, it's terrible. But as far as the size of the entire brain, it's really pretty good without being able to go inside. So it's in this medium resolution. As opposed to fMRI, which has a resolution of about a millimeter, so we're about a factor of 10 off from fMRI. And while I'm on that topic, I can go through my notes on contrasting MEG and fMRI. fMRI is much more visible. Most hospitals now have MRI. Whenever there's a nice pretty picture that comes from fMRI, it can go in the New York Times science section, and there's not so many pretty pictures that come from MEG. So fMRI is really, it's the winner as far as non-invasive monitoring of what's going on inside people's brains. On the other hand, for auditory neuroscience, fMRI is tricky because I don't know how many people here have had MRIs, but they're really loud. Anyone who's doing an auditory study with MRI is, by definition, doing a cocktail party study already. Whatever they want you to listen to, plus the sounds going on in the MRI. MEG is quiet. It doesn't take anything. We have electronics that amplify these signals. We have the liquid helium that's being cooled. There's no sound. There's no sound generated by the scanner. There's also no strong magnetic field. MRI has typically a 1.5 or 3 tesla field to be able to generate the radio frequency signals that are measured. We don't want those magnetic fields. In fact, MEG requires These days, the subject's to be put into a magnetically shielded room because the Earth's magnetic field is way bigger than a few hundred femtotesla. A magnetically shielded room, we can get down another, say, six orders of magnitude, which is still not enough, but it's definitely helpful. In fact, one of our noise sources, is really annoying, but it makes a lot of sense, is vibrations of the building, or typically of the bedrock that the building is on, because we've designed these to be attached to the bedrock as much as possible. On a college campus, there are often vibrations across campus. Fans, at our last site, we had this really annoying 17 hertz, a very strong, very narrowband signal, which was caused by a fan that moved air from one part of campus to another and had a very steady frequency. The vibrations hurt us because if the sensors are moving at 17 hertz and the Earth's magnetic field is not, then we register that as a changing magnetic field at 17 hertz. The place we are now, off campus, much quieter, much nicer. Compared to MRI, MRI works by using an indirect measure related to changes in oxygenation in the blood. So it doesn't measure a direct neural signal at all. It's still, as I said, very valuable, and its resolution is great. But what it's resolving is the blood vessels that are bringing in more or less oxygen according to metabolic activity that happened. So the time resolution of MRI depends on blood flow, and that's typically about 1 hertz. You might be able to get with some nice modeling 0.5 hertz, but really it's probably closer to 2 or 3 hertz in practice. There's also typically a time lag of about 10 seconds, but that's okay. 10 seconds is easier to subtract off. So MEG, like EEG, is really getting these direct measurements of neural activity because it's the electrical activity of the neurons as they're happening. So we typically record not at a sampling rate not of 1 hertz, but of a kilohertz. For MEG, it's also really nice that the brain, the skull, the scalp, are all transparent to magnetic fields. It's a constant, really boring diamagnetic material. In contrast, EEG has an intrinsic problem that the brain is a strong dielectric and it's inhomogeneous and anisotropic. So it's just a giant mess. It can be modeled, but the modeling that you have to do depends on the amount of work that you're going to get put into it. And so the people who really do that in EEG tell me they can get a centimeter also, and I believe them, but most people who do EEG don't put that much work into it. And maybe divide the brain into 8 octants, and that's where you're talking about sources of activity. To be fair, MEG has a different problem, which is that the inverse problem of mapping the magnetic field you measure to the current is not well defined. There's an infinite number of solutions. This basically comes down to the fact that we don't have magnetic monopoles, aside from the one that was seen in Stanford when I was an undergrad. And so if you try to invert Maxwell's equations to find out what the currents are generating these, there's no unique solution. So what's required is that you have to add a constraint. And there's a number of reasonable constraints that are put in. As soon as you put in a reasonable constraint, you do get a unique solution. And then the only question is, if you put in 2 or 3 different reasonable constraints, do you get the same answer? And if you do, then all those constraints were reasonable, and the solution you get is probably the right one. That's a fundamental obstacle, but it doesn't stop us from getting work. All right, how are we doing? Good. All right, so
let's put over here.
I'm going to draw here a person's head looking down. As you'll notice, these are the 2 ears. And this is going to be a flattened head, so not just a projection, but I'm going to take the ears and put them out so that when I'm sitting back here, you'll be able to see all of the currents around my head, all the magnetic fields. If I play, let's say, a simple time frequency, a simple pure tone, no harmonics, for some amount of time, it's at some frequency, it turns on, it turns off, then what happens is as a function of time, and let's say this is 100 milliseconds, and this is 200 milliseconds, and this is the magnetic field at some channel, we get not much going on, and then we get a strong deflection at about 50 milliseconds, and then a stronger deflection in the opposite direction at 100, and then there's some other stuff over there that is really important for some people, but it's too late for me to spend my time.
Can you give us a sense for the time for the signal? On the bottom plot.
This is sound.
That's understood. The time axis.
So
when does sound end?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say this is 100 milliseconds. And then what's happening from this is time for one sensor. It's hard for me to draw a two or three dimensional movie on the board, but there's not a lot of coherent activity. But then at around 50 milliseconds, you get say an outgoing, a source magnetic field, a sink magnetic field, a sink magnetic field, and a source magnetic field turning on, and that corresponds to magnetic fields that are going like this. They're coming out and then going back in. And that corresponds to currents, by the right-hand rule, don't ignore the left-hand, that are pointing in, this is going this way, so it points that way. This is going the other way, so it points that way. So you get symmetric currents. So the magnetic fields are anti-symmetric, but the underlying currents are actually symmetric. And there are much trickier ways and more accurate ways of figuring out what the neural source is. But if you make the assumption that it's one or a small number of current sources, of current dipoles, then basically you can look at these and say, this part of my brain is active, and that's auditory cortex, is this area over here. Then what happens is 50 milliseconds later, there's been a lot of activity, and it's kind of messy, but by that 50 milliseconds later, and it's changed polarity, and it's also moved for a little bit. Not a lot. And then what that represents is that whatever part of the brain was doing this processing with a 50 milliseconds latency, that's over and done. There's now another part which it took 50 milliseconds more for the neural signal to get there. So it went from the ear to lower parts of the brain, to middle parts of the brain, to auditory cortex, to other parts of auditory cortex, to other parts of auditory cortex. By the time it's 100 milliseconds after the tone was turned on, then there's this other part, which is its current has the opposite orientation, and it's in a slightly different part of auditory cortex. But it's still an auditory cortex. Alright, so
that frequency stop after some time less than 100 milliseconds, or did it keep going?
In this case, it usually stops.
Is that part of why it goes negative, or is the negative habituation or whatever to that?
It's a fantastic question. And for typical simple experiments, these tone tips can be short or long. It depends on what they're being used for. This is all part of what's called the onset response. When it turns off, there can be another part called the offset response, and that will lock in time to when the offset is. But these two are very stable in terms of the offset response. So what I do when I want to have a very simple version of the cocktail party problem is I'll have say this is 1 second. I'll have someone listening to two sets of repeating tones, which are kind of like two people talking at the same time. One is going beep, 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 and the other is going beep, 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 beep. And they're both mixed together, and you have no trouble separating these out. And I can say, listen to the fast one, or I can say, listen to the high frequency one, or listen to the slow, and it's very, very easy. And let's say, let's give these some numbers, that this is 4 hertz, and this is 7 hertz. And I'll do this many, many times in many, many different frequencies. I'll row the frequencies, I'll flip the order, because I don't care so much about the specific tones. I just want to model what's going on in terms of being able to segregate one stream out of another stream. Then I can plot the MET response. And now I'm going to plot it, actually, I'll plot the power spectral density. So here's 4 hertz, and here's 7 hertz. And it looks something like this. If the subject has been told to only pay attention to the slow one, whereas if I tell them, if I ask the subject to pay attention only to the fast one, it looks like this. So we have an example here of, and this is going to drive people a little crazy, who are interested in how the brain makes a faithful representation of the sound. This is a non-faithful representation of the sound. This is a representation of the sound that is in your best interests if you get rewarded for listening to the fast one instead of the slow one, or the slow one instead of the fast one. This is related to in the cocktail party scenario of, let's say there's 3 people talking all at the same time, all around you, and you're listening to one of them, maybe in front of you, maybe not in front of you. You can hear, if they're loud enough, and your hearing is healthy, everything they're saying. You can repeat back every detail of the story if it's interesting or important enough. But what the other people are saying, it's a little blurry. You know there's people there, but you can't report what they're saying. But at any moment, you can switch and attend to one of the others, and the exact same thing happens. Very, very clear, the second person now, the first person is becoming distinct. So our perception has changed, and our perception has changed in a very beneficial way. It's in our best interest because we, our brain, whatever is going on, have decided that we care about some sounds and not others. Yeah?
Just to add a detail, when you say that an earlier stage of even cortical processing that you have more faithful representation of, say, the repetition rate, in this case, that's not going to be changing with attention. And then as you go up, perhaps you have this. Just to clarify that,
yes,
your brain doesn't always lie.
Well, no. So, well, I mean,
this
but
there are parts of it that actually give you the faithful representation.
Yes. So most of the brain is really giving you the faithful representation. And I'm personally really interested in the part that you say it lying. Say it's lying, I say it's really helping you out.
Yes.
It's really giving you more control over the craziness going on around you and say, look, I can help with this craziness, just like it helps with color consciousness.
But in a sense, don't you imagine that you need both parts in order to have this happen?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So you absolutely need, and so different parts of cortex are more faithful or less faithful to the actual sound of the auditory scene, and other parts are more faithful or less faithful to the part that you and your brain have figured out is the important part and is trying to represent that as accurately as possible. And you need to go back because you never know when the person that you're not listening to turns out to say something really important, or the person you are talking to is really becoming very, very boring and you're looking for an escape route to a different conversation.
Do you ever try to combine these experiments with visual input as well, for example, as a lip reading?
Absolutely. So lip reading, when the sound sources are separated, that helps a lot. When they're different pitches, that helps a lot. When you can see lip moving, that helps a lot. It looks like, and this is not my work, but it's some beautiful work by at Lowther's group, that it's not so much lip reading. It's not knowing which lip combinations correspond to which sounds. It looks like it's much more of the rhythm. So if you see the mouth moving or even the vocal cords moving with a certain rhythm, that helps the part of your brain segregating where you say, let's look for something with that rhythm. If it corresponds to that rhythm, then we can give that a feedback boost, and if it doesn't, we can give it a feedback suppression.
How come we don't have a visual cocktail party problem?
We...
Picket fence, maybe?
Sorry?
The picket fence for stationary.
Yeah, we...
And then structure for motion.
We do have visual cocktail party problems, but they're much more subtle. One main difference between visual information, auditory information, is visual information can be, visual information comes in 2D. It hits our retina as a 3D screen. Okay. And so we can more or less choose which parts to attend to, so we get the space for free. Another is that visual information can be obstructed, and auditory information is always transparent. And so as soon as we have an edge, then also that gives us a leg up on what's going on. And in the auditory information, in some sense, there's no edges. Everything is just linearly added as it comes into your ears. So there are examples, but they're much more subtle, really.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But the phase difference between the between these 2 years can give you some special preferability, right?
Absolutely. So if there's one sound, then the time delay between reaching this year and reaching that year, called interaural time difference, it's typically a few hundred microseconds. Absolutely useful information, and depending on whether it's zero or whether it's a few hundred microseconds, can give you all kinds of useful information. The loudness, if it's a higher frequency signal, there's a head shadow effect that can give you information. The shapes of your ears, the pinna here, is beautiful for distorting sounds in a spatially directed way. And so if we know what the sound is and we've seen that it's been cut out at some frequency versus some other, we can get all kinds of information about where the sound is. That's for one sound. If there's three sounds, this is all being linearly added.
But you know for all the sounds that you know spatial, you know, you have the spatial coordinate for all the three sounds.
We don't have that. We have to derive that. That's the problem, is we have to derive it. And we do. And we do it so well that we think of it perceptually as we know where it is, so that's why we can separate them. But that's because the brain has already done that for you. So another
one? Yeah, you talked about the visual rhythmic perception. I wonder if that's why what you need listening to a ventriloquist dummy and deciding whether what's coming out of it whether that's a reasonable source of the sound or not.
Yeah, so when auditory and visual information is congruent, it helps. When they're not congruent, then we might use one cue or the other. And so ventriloquism works for that way. Dubbing works because it turns out that the mix can be completely sloppy. And as long as it's not a couple of hundred milliseconds difference between when the lips move and when you hear the sound, We'll give it a pass. And it's looking like that I'm running out of time. So I find that this is also a really good time to stop. I'm happy to take more questions afterwards.
Is there any explanation of why a balance is connected to the auditory system? And why certain animals, when they hear a rhythmic sound, move their hands around, or whatever they've got, in time.
The balance and hearing organs being related, that really comes from evolution.
It's just an accident, right?
It's an accident is one way of putting it. Another way of putting it, though, is there were originally these hair cells in some early life form that could detect vibrations. And because there were different ones nearby, or some of them were duplicated accidentally by a genetic mutation, once that happens, they could go off and do different things.
Thanks.
The rhythm of people who are nervous or animals, there are definitely deep connections to rhythm, but and I'm aware of some of them, but not in any depth.
What's the longest duration a tone has to have before you can discern the frequency when you're doing these experiments?
If it's loud enough, about one cycle. If it's quiet, then you need a lot more time, maybe many cycles.
Yes, Gary.
Could you say just a few words about aging and any advice you might
have? What did you say? The auditory system with aging, and they're really probably not related. One is that the neural transduction at your ear gets worse. You lose dynamic range, you need louder sounds to hear anything. And hearing aids are really great with that. If you're in a quiet room and you can't hear the TV, you can put a hearing aid in, turn it on, and then you can hear the TV. They're fantastic. The other thing that's going on, though, is that there's just a lot more slop developing in your central nervous system. That when signals move from one place to another, when you're young and healthy, there are these beautiful axons that have these glistening myelin insulation that gets all the signals to the right place at the right time. And when you get older, the myelination is not so steady, and you get these signals arriving at the right place, but sort of scattered in time. It's like having a sharp wavefront versus a dispersed wavefront. And so, since the timing information is so important for the auditory system, then when there's a complex sound, like many things going on at the same time, that information has been distorted, disrupted, and it's much harder for the brain to model what it should have been in the first place. There's other things going on. There's some excitation versus inhibition imbalance. Usually the positive current and negative currents are very finely tuned. As animals get older, that seems to not be the case. That's less understood. That actually is some reason to hope that we might be able to help with some of this. I'm involved with one project where with some training, we can get older adults. We have a group of people all over 80 who can get better at listening to speech and noise. Because that positive-negative inhibition imbalance seems to be something that we can counteract with training.
That's almost the question I was going to ask. How much of this is completely innate here? We're born with the circuitry. How much is learned?
The answer is both. There's stuff that we are innately born with that makes us fantastic. We're also very plastic. There's a lot of plasticity. We can learn things incredibly well. Someone can change the shape of your ears so that all those signals are wrong. And then within a couple of days, new spatial maps can be figured out. And then you gain all of your original agility. But with plasticity in the positive direction also comes plasticity in the negative direction. And as the inputs degrade in quality, or in degrade in strength, then the system can degrade in its ability to process sounds also.